Quilt is a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queen's.
If you're interested in the fantastic minds of your peers, check us out on Instagram at QUQuilt to read our volumes of creative and academic writing.
Stay tuned for more information about our upcoming launch event.
Love, Quilt.
I should unwalk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus, cool professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend?
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, November 1st, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering the Kingston Symphony's first ever relaxed performance on Sunday, the city's very first Welcome to Kingston Day last weekend, the 50th anniversary of the Banree Women's Centre on Queen's campus, and more. Over the weekend, the city hosted the first Welcome to Kingston Day, celebrating new residents and offering them resources to settle in. This has been an initiative the city has been working on for the last year, starting with a survey to gauge community interest and culminating in the celebrations that took place on Sunday. The day started with a citizenship ceremony at the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, and then led into the New to Kingston Fair in Springer Market Square. The city's manager of equity, diversity, and inclusion, Vanessa Mensa, sat down with CFRC to reflect on the first Welcome to Kingston Day. The city was able to host the inaugural Welcome to Kingston Day on Sunday. Starting off, how was it seeing the result of all the work you've been putting into this for the last year?
It was really exciting. And so I love when our community comes together. And so this was in a city of Kingston alone. We have wonderful community partners that we work alongside of my colleague, UJR from KIPP, as well as Kingston Immigration Partners, as well as many other community partners that came together to make this day a success.
And you started off with the citizenship ceremonies in the morning at Kingston Frontenac Public Library. How was sharing that experience with residents, not only just new to Kingston, but new to Canada?
Yeah, that was really exciting. It was really great to see folks come who were not even receiving their citizenship and wanted to observe, had never heard. And this is what the day was about. It was a day of learning as well. And oftentimes in our department, when we are our division, when we do put on events like this, it's very much a celebratory, but it's also a learning opportunity. And it was great to see folks coming out of the community and observe and to and also really nice to watch newcomers take their oath and just, you know, become new citizens and also remain in our community. That's really exciting, right? That Kingston can be home to so many others.
Yeah, absolutely. And after that, it led into the fair for the afternoon. How was that? And what did you hear from folks who got to explore all the options that you had for them?
Yeah, so it was a great feedback from both community members, but also the participants themselves as well. And so it was nice. What we're hearing from community is that thank you for really thinking outside of the box, right? And so it wasn't necessarily geared towards newcomers only, where we were trying to help them with their settlement, but it was also folks who were coming from Ajax or from, I don't know, Toronto or from Halifax, right? It was really nice for them to see how they can be integrated in the community. So finding resources, you know, learning about our community, learning about our council group, learning about, you know, the offerings that the city offers, like transportation, busing, accessibility, the accessible bus. So it was really great just to be able to have a variety of offerings for folks to learn and to glean from.
Mensa also gave more details on the scale of both the citizenship ceremony and the fair.
For the citizenship ceremony, there was a room capacity. And so we know that we had between 50 to 60 participants who became citizens that day. It's really exciting. And of that, they also had their family and friends that were over as well, too, and who participated in the event as well, too. So probably will bring us a total of about 120 people. But we did have people who had to actually stand behind the glass in the room door and observe from a glass window because the room was packed. It was a capacity of 120. We couldn't fit all of those who wanted to see the event. So that was really exciting. We had dignitaries, we had the mayor, we had councils, we also had MP and MPP also be, were also present there as well too. In fact, the room was so full that we had to have the choir that was singing O Canada perform outside of the room. But again, their voices was incredible. And so it was able to project into the room, but that's how full the room was, which tells me that Kingston is really excited to have and to host opportunities like this and events like this, where we are able to draw newcomers and new citizens into our community. And so that was for the morning part, the 9 to 12, which is the citizenship ceremony. For the Welcome to Kingston Fair, that was, another exciting day. There was a really good pace of people that were going through. And so I anticipate anywhere between maybe 750 to 1,000 people that went through the day. Again, it was a very short time from 12 to 3 p.m. And so it was a nice study, a gradual move of folks in City Hall, as well as on the Springer Market Square area. I saw some folks that were lining up for the free City Hall tours, which was really exciting as well too. And so it was a good pace of the day. It wasn't overcrowded, but it wasn't also I wasn't underwhelmed, to put it that way. I was very, very pleased with the turnout. And again, for an inaugural day, it was really rewarding to see just what the turnout was for that day.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you mentioned there you had a spread of events for every person and for folks who are interested in all these different things. What was the crowd like? Was it mostly families, some students? Was it a big mix?
Yeah. It was a good mix. So we had some students. It was really nice to see our students, both from SLC, RMT, as well as Queen's University, be there. Queen's had a few tables there. So that was really exciting to see what you're doing also for your own students as well, too. We had families come out. And we also had some individuals who were like, oh, you know what? I've been really lonely. I've been in the community for a while. I don't have family here, and wanting to learn more about how they can be plugged in. I did see this person who had their camera. I was like, I just need to capture every minute of this because I might forget everything. And so that was really exciting to also see just the enthusiasm from the community as well.
Yeah, that sounds like a super exciting day. And I'm just personally curious, what was your strategy to be able to reach people to bring them out to this event? Did people let you know where they heard about this event from, especially as newcomers?
Yeah, so I must tell you that we have an incredible comms team. And so shout out to Monica, who's our comms lead for this event. And so we did things like, the Curbex that we had around the city. We had a social media campaign as well too. But we also tapped directly into the newcomers to from different nations to the Kingston area. We really tapped into them and said, hey, we went where they were and said, come and be part of this event. We also went to different employment resource, support agencies, where we know when you're new to the area, you're looking for work and who you're going to go to. And so we had a really great strategy to reach out to people. So families, we knew library, great ways for families to be, for where families hang out. So we went to where the people are, as well as, you know, the social media campaigns, as well as just the word of mouth and whatnot. So it was great to see a variety of people there. My children were there and they had a blast. There were activities. Shout out to the escape room as well too, who had an activity there. And so we're keeping the kids engaged, but as well as adults and many others. It was great.
Yeah, for sure. Does the city plan to make this an annual event?
Yeah, so that I'm hearing from the council group that might be what they, that is what they are expecting for us to be able to present a day like this. And so I do expect for this to take place again next year. We have newcomers come in every month, every week in our community. And so I know that council has designated this Welcome to Kingston Day as a way for us to acknowledge and welcome our new members, new residents.
Do you think it'll pop up more times throughout the year, or do you think it'll be Welcome to Kingston Day celebrated reliably each October?
Yeah. So we're still working on the day because I know it's quite cold, right? And so how do we ensure that we have a bigger turnout and more engagement from the community? So at this point right now, we're looking at October, but that might change based on what we hear from the community and the feedback. We're still collecting feedback from the community. In terms of multiple events, I know that there are many events throughout the day, throughout the year, that really focuses on highlighting the newcomer experience. And so it's not going to be an isolated event. The Welcome to Kingston Day will remain the day, but we do have, International Student Summit that welcomes international students. We have a variety of different opportunities that also celebrate new residents and newcomers as well, too. And so this is just not necessarily like the where it ends, but really like the hurrah, like the biggest event of all.
Once again, that was Vanessa Mensah, Manager of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion with the City of Kingston on the very first Welcome to Kingston Day. As Mensah mentioned, Kingstonians can look forward to this event returning in the future. The Kingston Symphony is performing their first ever relaxed performance this weekend at the Kingston Grand Theater, offering a new experience and opening the doors for more audience members. A relaxed performance is a concert which does away with some of the typical formalities associated with shows, allowing audience members to move freely, express themselves vocally, and come and go as they please. Audience members also have access to resources like a quiet room, sound-dampening headphones, and fidget toys. The relaxed performance setup welcomes audiences who may benefit from a more relaxed environment, including neurodiverse and disability communities. This new inclusive format for the orchestra will be debuted at their first family concert series of the 2024-25 season, Harmon Live, based off of the popular Harmon in Space web series created by the symphony during the pandemic. Evan Mitchell, music director and principal conductor of the Kingston Symphony, spoke with CFRC about this milestone for the orchestra.
This is the symphony's first family concert series of the year coming up on Sunday with Harmon Live. What can folks expect from this show?
So there's a couple of things that are noteworthy about this particular performance. Harmon in Space, of course, is our celebrated web series that we created during the pandemic. We have two seasons worth of live content on YouTube, free for anyone to see. Harmon is something that we're very proud of, and it was originally put together with the hope that we would be able to do live shows in this manner. So it's always a joy to be able to present Harmon to the public this way. It's going to be essentially the first seasons of Harmon in Space, but live on stage with the symphony and with Harmon as our special guest on stage. So that's obviously a very important thing. Secondly, though, this is going to be our very first relaxed performance. And relaxed performances are there for audiences who may have felt othered in one way or another. We basically take away a lot of the stigma and the convention of audience behavior that one would perhaps associate with a live concert. And we remove that, and we have all sorts of we have facilities and we have resources there to make it a comfortable and a relaxed experience for everyone who's coming. For example, there's going to audience members will have access to a quiet room where there's comfortable seating if they need to take a break, some fidget toys. There's a row at the back end of the hall, which will be left empty if people need to get a little bit further away from the physical, from the intensity of the music. And the lights will be dimmed a little bit, but it'll still be bright enough that you can see all around you. And so it won't be a darkened environment. We're really taking into account and consideration the needs of a wide variety of audience members. And we think that this is a concert for them to feel safe and secure in and enjoy the symphony orchestra.
You dove right into what exactly a relaxed performance is. What made the symphony decide to make this the first one?
Well, it's something that we've been looking at for quite some time. And naturally, I think the most logical option for dipping our toes into this format is a family concert, concert for young people. And it's really important for us at the symphony to be able to give access for young people to this great music so that they can build a life of being appreciative of great art. I think that that's really important. I found that myself to be one of the most important gifts that I was given when I was a young person. And so we've just been thinking about all the barriers that potentially exist to being able to present this to everyone. And relaxed performances take away a lot of those barriers. And so it really is a wonderful match. And we're excited this is our first one. Harmon, of course, as I've said, is one of our proudest achievements of recent years. And the thought of being able to share Harmon on a larger scale to a broader audience is something that we're very proud to be able to do and excited to be able to do with our very first relaxed concert.
That's awesome. Yeah. And how can folks enjoy the concert on Sunday?
Well, so you come to the Grand Theater, you purchase a ticket, you come in, and basically from there, the experience is tailored to be low stress, No barriers. As I said, there's going to be access to a quiet room just in case anyone has to go and be away from the intensity of the stimulus of the concert. We've got that row of seats at the back end of the hall are going to be kept empty. We have released a venue guide so that everyone will know in advance what the sequence of events is going to be. And crucially for understanding the way that the audience is sort of going to react to the orchestra. Audience members are welcome to get up and move around. They can express themselves vocally. They can stim. They can do whatever they need to do. If they come and go, it's absolutely no problem. And so a lot of the aspects of expected audience behavior that we have for a typical concert, we're saying that absolutely doesn't matter at all. We're just here for you and to support you as an audience member. And I think that's the really that's the heart of the relaxed performance model.
Once again, that was Kingston Symphony Music Director Evan Mitchell on the orchestra's first ever relaxed performance taking place at the Kingston Grand Theater this Sunday. As of this month, the Ban Ray Center on Queen's campus has been providing resources for women students for 50 years. The Ban Ray Center opened in October of 1974. Founded by women graduates of Queens with the vision of creating a space to provide support for mature women students. Since its inception, it has continued to foster a community among women from all faculties and from all stages of life. This includes providing student advising, advocacy on behalf of students, and a plethora of events throughout the year. The center celebrated this milestone year with a gala at the Isabel Bader Center at the end of last week, also unveiling the results of the Who Is She fundraising campaign. This campaign began last fall, asking donors to make contributions in honor of an important woman in their lives. The women who inspired these donations were recognized in an art installation revealed at the gala, which will soon reside in the Ban Ray Center for all visitors to see. Susan Bellier, director of the Ban Ray Center, sat down with CFRC at the center to reflect after the gala.
Celebrating 50 years, to start us off before we get into the celebration itself, how are you feeling about hitting 50 years and all that Ban Ray Center has provided for the Queens community over the years?
Yeah, we have spent so much of this past year preparing for this moment, which was the grand gala to celebrate 50 years. But really, we've been celebrating all year long. We had, we had our Who Is She campaign. We got in touch with a whole lot of alumni to find out what they're doing now. And we have a little slideshow of that. We had at our spring awards celebration, Diane McKenzie, an alumna of Queens and a big supporter of the Ban Ray Foundation, told the history of how the center got started. We had a tree planted and a plaque dedicated to the founders. So we've been working on the 50th all year. And it culminated last night, October 24th, in our grand gala event at the Isabel Bader Center. And that was amazing. Yeah, sure. So it was in the atrium in the lobby of the Isabel. So the beautiful open space. There were about 180 people in attendance. We had Chantel Thompson and her band perform. Chantel's an alumni who used to use the Ban Ray Center. We had a number of students sort of testimonials about the impact of this place and their time here. We had had a video made, Jung Ah, who is a videographer and a student in cultural studies. She made a beautiful video that captures some of the activities that go on in this space. I gave a little pitch and showed off my new shoes, all of that sort of thing. And then there was a whole lot of mingling and just meeting and greeting, meeting new people and catching up with people I've known. And it was just everything we wanted it to be. There was cake, there was hors d'oeuvres, there was punch. So we're really looking forward to debriefing on it as staff and as our board of directors as well was very involved. So we are looking forward to congratulating ourselves and each other on how amazingly well it went.
So yeah, and you also did the reveal of the results of the Who Is She campaign that you've been running all year. How is that?
So Who Is She? This was a reboot of a campaign we did about 10 years ago where we asked people to submit a tribute to an important woman in their life, an inspiring woman in their life. Many people chose a sister, a mother, a mentor, a teacher. Some chose a daughter. Just, you know, a little story about a woman who inspires you. And we had people ask people to make a donation and submit a tribute. So the tributes were printed up and displayed on this beautiful wall last night, in frames, each of the tributes. And we had some books created too that capture all the tributes in the books, along with some photos. And the tributes were on display last night. And as you mentioned, we are going to be mounting them all as a display in the house that will be up for a while, I think. Probably we hope to get it up sometime in early November, and we'll certainly make an announcement about it through social media and our newsletter, and people can come in and at their leisure read some of the tributes. It is just so inspiring to learn the stories of the amazing women who have nurtured and inspired and sparked all the things that happen in our lives. It's it was such a celebratory piece of the evening last night, was to have this wall that people could go and read all the stories.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I feel like there's kind of this surge of energy after celebrating an anniversary. What are you looking forward to this year?
Oh, wow. Well, surge of energy, yes, after we take a weekend to rest. We have a hiring in process right now. Lisa Webb, a longtime student advisor here, has decided to retire after over 22 years of providing exceptional student advising. I mean, anyone who knows Lisa is heartbroken that she's decided to retire, but also really glad for her because she deserves it for sure. So we're in the middle of a hiring process. We'll be interviewing for that next week. So I'm looking forward to getting a new person in, seeing what new blood, new ideas, new skills and interests bring to the place. We're looking forward to turning our attention. You know, for the last year, we've been doing all these events and programming oriented towards the 50th anniversary, and at the same time continuing with our daily free soup lunch and our student programming for, you know, academic supports and career supports and personal supports. But we really get to now dive back into student programming in a bigger way. We work really hard to ensure that the programming we're offering matches the needs and the interests of the students who are using the center in any given year. So we'll be engaging with the students, find out what's working and what's maybe missing for them. And we'll be working to create a really robust series of, I don't know, events, programming, talks, parties, whatever feeds the soul and the spirit and the academic need for the students who come through here.
Once again, that was director of the Bannery Center, Susan Bellier, discussing the center's 50th anniversary year. Habitat for Humanity Kingston, in collaboration with the city, have officially opened an 8-unit tiny home project on McCully Street. While Habitat for Humanity typically helps individuals and families acquire their forever homes, the organization took on a new kind of project with this development, providing affordable rental housing with support services in place to help residents maintain stable and safe housing. Notably, two of the units are also designed to be fully accessible. This project was funded by the city and the federal government's Rapid Housing Initiative. The units were also built by students from Ernesttown Secondary School through the Limestone District School Board's Building Construction Internship Program. This project could not come at a more crucial time. With the city reporting 523 Kingstonians were precariously housed or unhoused at the end of 2023. So far, 5 residents have settled into the new rental units. I sat down with Alexa Gamash, Community Engagement Coordinator with Habitat for Humanity Kingston, to discuss the project. I was wondering if you'd like to just share a bit about this exciting tiny homes project that just opened and how long it's been in the works.
Yeah, for sure. So the Tiny Home Project has been in the works, I'd say, before 2021. It is an 8-unit tiny home project on McCully Street in Shannon Park. It's a beautiful neighborhood. So we have 8 unsheltered individuals or people experiencing homelessness heading into those homes right now in the next couple weeks. And those are 8 deserving individuals, many who have experienced systemic challenges, accessibility challenges, as well as homelessness. And they are going to be geared to income rentals. We've worked with a few organizations within our community that have helped us kind of partner with us to get some deserving individuals into these homes. So that's TP Moza. We've worked with Community Living, the former sleeping shelter, as well as Resolve. They are energy efficient units. And one of the really cool things about this project is we actually have two accessible units as well, that we're going to have two people move in who are experiencing accessibility challenges.
Thank you for that background. Are your doors open? Are residents getting settled in, or is that sort of on the horizon for us?
Yeah, no, for sure. So we've had actually a couple residents move in about a week ago. We have residents moving in as we speak, which is very exciting to see.
Do you know how many residents you currently have?
Right now, I think there is 5 that are officially moved in.
Good stuff. And for Habitat for Humanity, this is not your traditional focus or project. Is this project kind of new territory? I was wondering if you could share a bit about this change in approach.
Yeah, for sure. So here at Habitat, our mission is to provide affordable housing and homeownership for deserving families within our Kingston community. So here we believe that everyone needs a safe and decent place to call home. So with our tiny home project, we are focused on affordable housing, but it's a bit different because these are geared to income rentals. So it's a similar project where we are looking at affordable housing for these individuals, but they're not forever homes, obviously. These are rental units. But yeah.
So you're sort of staying in that same territory, same mission, same goals, but a bit of a different approach this time.
Yeah. So our Habitat Canada, this is not typically the work that we do, because we don't typically have rentals. We focus on home ownership. But this project does focus again with kind of our vision of strength, stability, and self-reliance, and really providing these people with a shelter and a place to call home.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I believe these units were built by students from Ernestown Secondary School through the Limestone District School Board's Building Construction Internship Program. I was wondering if you could speak about that a bit.
So the home's been built by 3 different cohorts of students at Ernestown Secondary School. It's part of the BCIP program. And these students worked hard every day. They learned valuable skills while contributing to a project that will have a lasting impact on our community. And their dedication was key to making this project a reality.
And you officially had a bit of an opening celebration. How was that?
It was so wonderful. I think everybody left truly inspired by the words that were shared. We had people from the different organizations and the partners that we've worked with. The MP spoke, the mayor spoke. We had a lady from TP Moses speak, who we've been working alongside with, Winnie Peters, and Gary Lees, the CEO of Habitat Kingston, spoke, and it was just a really wonderful opportunity to see kind of everything come together, and all of the people that have partnered with us on this project. We had a resident speak, and it was so beautiful to hear her words, and she told us that, you know, her goal was to have a home, and she reached that goal, and now she's so excited to be able to help future Habitat owners kind of build their home next. So we're always looking into the future, and we're always looking for our next builds and to provide more people in our community with affordable housing. But it was really great to get together and have that celebration with all the people that we've worked with. And it really just goes to show how much of a community it takes to put this together and really pull it off.
Once again, that was Alexa Gamash with Habitat for Humanity Kingston on their recently opened 8-unit tiny home project in collaboration with the city. Kingston is expecting 2 other Rapid Housing Initiative projects to open by the end of the year, one offering housing to individuals who identify as Indigenous in significant housing need, and another for participants in the stabilization program managed by Addiction and Mental Health Services, KFLNA. Kingston Economic Development Corporation, KED, and the Community Foundation for Kingston and Area, CFKA, have partnered up to launch a new workshop series to help not-for-profit organizations tackle their unique challenges. CFKA Executive Director Stacey Kelly noticed how nonprofits face their own unique challenges, including often lacking staff in certain areas, working on a tight budget, and not having a specific product to market. With over 150 registered nonprofits in Kingston, these organizations make up a significant chunk of Kingston's economy. While typically CFKA provides support through grant funding, Kelly reached out to KED to see what other kinds of support they can provide. CFRC sat down with Kelly and Rob Tamblin, a business development manager with KED,
to discuss how they came together to create the Not-for-Profit Academy series, launching today and continuing on November 13th with two marketing-based workshops. Here is that conversation. I was wondering if you'd like to just both introduce yourselves and your roles with this series.
So my name is Stacey Kelly, and I'm the Executive Director of the Community Foundation for Kingston and Area. And I guess I might call myself the instigator of this idea, but I knew that in order for it to flourish, you wanted to have a partner. And so we reached out to our wonderful friends at Kingston Economic Development Corporation.
And I'm Rob Tamblyn. I'm a business development manager for the Kingston Economic Development Corporation. And I'd echo Stacey's thoughts. I think we certainly had heard from organizations within the community about lacking some resources and whatnot in the not-for-profit sector. So when Stacey approached us, it was like, yes, this makes total sense. Let's do it.
Stacey, you mentioned there you were the instigator of this project. What sort of sparked the interest in starting the series?
When I returned to Kingston in August 2022 to take on this role, I did what I've been sort of calling my rediscovery tour of Kingston and meeting with a bunch of staff, leaders, and program folks from a variety of the agencies that we fund across the city. And it came really obvious to me that there were some challenges and gaps in both capacity and resources that our agency partners were facing. And that led me to think that as wonderful it is that we are a granting organization and provide funding through grants, it's not the only way we can support addressing some of these issues and gaps and opportunities for collaboration for these wonderful agencies. And so it occurred to me that perhaps there was support beyond granting that we really should be thinking about creating to address the needs of our community partners.
Awesome. And Rob, what did you think when Stacey came to you with this idea?
Well, as I said, I think, we certainly we're in touch with a number of different organizations within the Kingston business community. When people think economic development, they always think for profit, but that certainly isn't always the case. We had heard about, challenges that those in the not-for-profit sector are facing, and it seemed to be some commonalities. So, as I said, when Stacey chatted with us, we thought, well, this would be a perfect thing to partner in and launch.
Great. And we'll dive a bit more into the details in a minute, but what is the Not-for-Profit Academy series for folks who have never heard of it before?
Well, what we're trying to do is this is really the kickoff, because we anticipate having more. One of the first sort of gaps that we noticed that people had is there's a lot of not-for-profits that don't have dedicated marketing communication staff, for example. And so we thought this would be maybe a nice, easy and early kind of win, and sort of, we want to provide value, right? So we reached out to some experts in the city to help develop the first two opening sessions for this academy. So the first is around strategic communication planning, which is in October 30th. And then in November 14th, it's sort of almost like, think of it like, if you're in school during the prerequisites, it's not required, but I think it's sort of part two, a little bit more in depth. It's around audience mapping and key messaging for nonprofits. So really sort of building on the fundamental knowledge of the first session. But of course, you can register for both. You can register for one and however. And what we want to do with that is then, survey our participants and understand more about what other types of topics they'd like to hear from us. Where are those knowledge gaps that we could help them develop in terms of their capacity for their organizations?
It sounds like you're going to do some digging to find out exactly what folks in the nonprofit sector are looking for. But starting off, how are these workshops going to differ from other business-oriented workshops? What are some of those things that differentiate nonprofits from other kinds of businesses that cause them to require this unique approach?
Well, I mean, I guess from our perspective, most of the workshops that we run are targeted specifically to businesses who either have a product or service to sell to, their target market. So there's a certain way to do that. And quite often would be an easier thing to do than when you're looking at the audience that a not-for-profit
targets. So I think that there's some subtle nuances and some differences that make it a really a unique learning opportunity. So that's what we're really trying to do with the two sessions coming up on marketing is really look at it from the vision of these organizations in the not-for-profit sector, because they certainly face unique challenges that for-profit companies don't.
Yeah, and Stacey, did you have anything on that?
Oh, I love what Rob said, and I agree. I think just to build on that, the key differentiator here is that our two presenters, the co-leads who developed these two courses, have developed it from that perspective, as Rob was saying, of the not-for-profit organization, which has slightly different levers, slightly different North Star than the for-profit. While there are similarities in terms of we are all enterprises, the key differentiator there being, as Rob was alluding, is a slightly different sort of pivot around what are the different levers we have in terms of marketing ourselves, what are the levers for raising revenues? Traditionally, right, we don't have sort of a product array. How do we differentiate ourselves even within our own market amongst other nonprofits and around that sort of audience, understanding who our audiences are, what's the right messaging to build for those audiences, to build, build an audience, build and inspire and engage around the cause and our mission.
Yeah, for sure. And Rob, you mentioned right off the top that maybe not-for-profits isn't immediately what people are thinking about when they think Kingston Economic Development. I was wondering if you could both dive a bit deeper into the importance of supporting our not-for-profits and providing series like this, even though it might not be immediately what people think of when they think Kingston Economic Development.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, I think that the stat in Kingston is there's over 150 registered not-for-profits in the city. So certainly, they have a huge impact on the overall economic activity in the greater Kingston area. And that's not just in terms of the number of people that they employ, but the number of goods and services that they buy within the community. I mean, to be honest, I think that it's also growing, right? So I think recognizing that and doing something that's specifically for them will go a long way to helping that sector.
Yeah, for sure. And Stacey, did you have anything on that?
Well, yeah, and thank you very much, Rob, for providing that local piece. Certainly, I have at my hands the Ontario sector. It may shock people to know that there's 58,000 nonprofits and charities in Ontario alone, who employ just under 900,000 people, and contributed just shy of 8% to the province's GDP. That's like $65 billion in economic impact. This is a huge sector. I think people often, in the news or cocktail parties, only think about the large, maybe more potentially, quote, sexy, for profit. But the reality is it's a massive sector that makes a huge impact, to Rob's point, on our local economies, our provincial economies, and of course at the national scale. So there's a lot of charities doing great work, and we're all still in that post-pandemic recovery phase. And there are challenges for the sector. There are headwinds in the sector. And so what we're trying to understand from the local context as a community foundation is what are those particular pressure points and stressors on our organizations, and what role can and should we play to help bolster our partners across the region? And in this case, again, it's we don't have unlimited financial resources. So part of the thinking was, okay, well, in addition to the granting that we do annually, what can we do to help support? And again, from that, understanding the needs of our organizations and where we think we can provide value.
Once again, that was Stacey Kelly with Community Foundation for Kingston and Area, and Rob Tamblyn with Kingston Economic Development on the Not-for-Profit Academy Workshop Series kicking off this afternoon and to be continued with more sessions planned in the future. Workshops are being held virtually and registration can be completed online at investkingston.ca/events. In 2023, the City of Kingston declared October as Plantiful Month, encouraging Kingstonians to explore plant-based food options both for their health and the environment during the month of October. 350 Kingston took the lead in providing workshops, seminars, and events for the community to learn more about plant-based options. At their last meeting, councillors passed a motion brought forward by Sydenham Councillor Connie Glenn, taking another step towards supporting plant-based options. The motion sees that the city commit to prioritizing and promoting plant-based food options,
by, for example, ensuring that plant-based options are included and prioritized whenever food is purchased or funded, and promoting these options by giving them, quote, a primary position when food is offered, such as at the front of a buffet table, end quote. The motion also states that the city will collaborate with community partners on educational campaigns promoting the benefits of a plant-rich diet, emphasizing, quote, sustainability, health, and cultural appreciation, end quote. The reasoning behind the motion was rooted in promoting overall health for Kingstonians and moving forward the city's sustainability goals. The motion cites the Canada Food Guidelines, which recommend at least 75% plant-based foods, including fruits, vegetables, grains, and plant proteins for a healthy diet. It also cites the contribution of our current food systems and practices to global greenhouse gas emissions. In the motion, it states that livestock production is responsible for about 14.5 to 28% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Dr. Henry Swoboda, a physician at Kingston Health Sciences Center, spoke to the motion before council.
We're talking about moving toward more plant-forward diets, which I believe are incredibly important for health, but you don't have to take my word for it. The Canada Food Guide very specifically says that we want to be primarily plant-based diets. If we do not change the way that we eat, the way that we do agriculture, our food environmental greenhouse gas budget will take up our entire greenhouse gas budget for everything by 2100. So we absolutely have to change the way that we eat. And this is a well regarded as the number one way to improve that environmental benefit.
Councillor Glenn presented the motion to council, reiterating the two main motivations of improving health and environmental impact.
This is really about some leadership in terms of the health of our community and the health of our environment. This is not a motion that pertains to telling other businesses what to do. It's about showing by example a different way forward in terms of how we eat. This, I think, is a reasonable motion that is, again, about moving that needle a little closer. All of the things that we're doing in terms of efforts to promote health and well-being, to take pressure off the healthcare system, which is overloaded, all of the initiatives that we're also working on towards addressing environmental and climate change, this is just another piece of that puzzle.
Councillor Brandon Tozzo added to the motion that city staff will report back with a clear strategy detailing how exactly the city will implement the initiative and measure progress by the end of 2025.
So I want to make sure we know what we're getting and that this can be implemented with a draft policy strategy. I reached out to staff and said, let's get them to make sure that they can come back with it. And let's make sure also that we can have the data that we need to be able to track it over a period of time of how our procurement strategy is going. For me, evidence-based decision-making is better. I think this adds to both also keeping us in track of how the motion is going and making sure that we can report back periodically with how we're doing with this strategy.
Councillor Wendy Stevens seconded that this accountability piece was what was missing from the motion.
This is the missing piece for me, and I think that this is exactly what I needed to see to not just believe in this motion, but fully wholeheartedly support it. I think it's a really great idea, and I like the idea of staff reporting back because we have so many different kinds of city facilities, and I don't know how you would sort of put the food sometimes council needs to eat for dinner compared to Slush Puppy Place, compared to Invista Center. Like there's so much variety there. So I think that having the ability to hopefully go away and come back to us with a plan is what I need to see.
With this amendment, the motion was approved with a vote of 10-3. While the motion passed, it was not without controversy. Councillor Jimmy Hassan, Councillor Gary Osteroff, and Mayor Brian Patterson were the three opposing votes. Councillor Hassan brought up the first concerns.
I'm surprised that I have to learn from my colleagues, from my politician, who I have no expertise on, to tell me what to eat, what not to eat. It's my tummy, it's my health, it's my choice, what should I eat? And I should be responsible. This is not our job to tell the people what to do, what not to do, especially when it's come to the food.
Councillor Osteroff, representing the rural district of Countryside, raised concerns about how the included statistics surrounding agriculture and the environmental impact of livestock come across from a rural perspective, as well as the general wording of the motion.
From a rural perspective, I'm disappointed in the motion because I think that even the fourth clause, referring to the livestock portion and the impact of agriculture and raising of animals, I think that there's plenty of science that indicates that these numbers are probably inaccurate. You know, I'm almost offended by that line, because I think it's playing with numbers. I think it's quite inaccurate. And some of the language in here, I don't find it friendly. I find actually Dr. Svoda was more invitational to us. I think it should be an invitation for us to participate. And I don't like to read in the therefore clauses where always ensuring and primary. It just feels forced to me.
After a 30-minute discussion, most counselors agreed it was the right choice to move forward with the initiative.
This motion is not about turning vegetarian. I think that, sorry to say, like last year, we're reading too much into it.
I think that this really does capture something that we really should be doing as the city of Kingston, trying to promote, you know, local grown food.
Councillor Glenn provided some closing remarks.
Farmers grow a wide variety of things, including livestock. So I think we need to recognize that. This is just asking that we start to pay a bit more attention and show a little bit of leadership, particularly in terms of the health elements. In terms of the experts, this is from the Canada Food Guide. Trust me, the experts have gone over it again and again and again, and they've rewritten it multiple times. The motion also isn't prescriptive. It's encouraging. It's about moving that needle. So there aren't targets that are laid out in here where we're saying tomorrow there must be this amount. This is about saying, okay, we're going down this pathway. Let's start on that prioritization.
I can assure everyone at the next mayor's barbecue that there will be regular burgers as well as veggie burgers. Thank you.
At their last meeting, City Council passed additional conditions for the Integrated Care Hub to maintain their funding from the city. The motion was brought forward by Councillor Gregory Ridge, councillor for the Kingstown District, where the Integrated Care Hub, the Consumption Treatment Services site, and the Bell Park encampment are located. The Integrated Care Hub has been at 661 Montreal Street since 2020, providing 24/7 low-barrier services to vulnerable residents, covering immediate needs such as safety, food, and rest, and longer-term needs such as addiction and mental health services. Councillor Ridge proposed that Addiction and Mental Health Services, KFLNA, the lead on Integrated Care Hub operations, submit a security and safety plan which is, quote, considerate of client, staff, neighborhood, and community safety, as well as form a community consultation group in order to maintain funding from the city for the Integrated Care Hub. Along with these conditions, it was also proposed that city staff collect data from Kingston Police, Frontenac Paramedic Services, and Kingston Fire and Rescue regarding calls and visits to the Integrated Care Hub and the surrounding neighborhood since the hub was established in 2020, to compare with data of other areas in the city. This data collection and analysis will be completed by the end of March 2025. This motion also comes after the events of September 12th, where two people were killed in an attack on Montreal Street, close to the Bell Park encampment and the Integrated Care Hub. The Integrated Care Hub has been closed since, and the neighboring Consumption Treatment Services site just reopened on October 17th. Councillor Ridge opened the discussion, sharing his reasoning behind bringing forward the motion.
We have to recognize that these services are essential, that they save lives. We also have to recognize that there has been a negative impact on the community there, and I'm sure that once the data is reviewed, that we'll have a better sense of what that negative impact is. But anecdotally, based on the hundreds of interactions I've had with constituents that live in that area, they would overwhelmingly say that that's the case. And we also have to take that into consideration. The only way that we as a municipality can make a positive difference is to recognize that both of these realities are true and to move forward in a way that works for everyone. And if we don't do that, we're going to be doomed to fail over and over and over again. Ultimately, these are a way to try and create trust in the community again, to create trust in the city, to create trust with our partnerships, and to address the needs of everybody here. Let's be clear about what this motion is not. This is not about punishing the ICH. This is not about punishing the staff. This is not about punishing people using your services. This is about trying to help everybody.
Councillors discussed the motion, mostly agreeing on the importance of the added conditions, and with hope that this is a move in the right direction for all Kingston residents.
Simultaneously, we can support consumption treatment centers and the services of the ICH and still recognize that is having an impact on the community. I remember canvassing 2 years ago up Montreal Street, which is several blocks away, and members of Rideau Heights talked about the impact that the ICH was having in several blocks away from it. So it is having an impact on the community here. I always think the city works better when we get as many people involved and engaged in a service as possible. When we take away any misconceptions of what it is, any misconception of what a service is. And I think that that's a key component here that in some ways has been kind of missing, that component of bringing the community on board with this. And I'm heartened by this, and I hope it works out well, because I think we have to prove to the province of Ontario, which I want everyone to keep in mind, that this works. Consumption treatment centers are under the eye of the province, and we have to make sure that we're showing that these services are vital and essential. They save lives. And I mean, the part on data collection, that just makes sense. We have to, the more evidence-based decision-making we can have, the better policy outcomes we will do.
This is a really interesting case of multiple truths, which is something I find we talk about often around here. So as Councillor Tozo mentioned, yes, we have these services, and yes, they are critically important, and yes, they are impacting the near neighbors and neighbors that are a bit further away as well. The time has come that, yes, we absolutely need a community consultation group. It just makes sense. So I want to thank you for bringing this. As you mentioned, Councillor Ridge, you know, there's a lot that we can't control, but I think that this is one small step in addition to the other items in your motion that can have an impact, and acknowledge that, you know, we care about everyone in our community, and that doesn't mean decisions are easy, and sometimes that means you're displeasing others to please, you know, certain people, but at the heart of it all, I think what we're trying to do is the right thing.
While the killings last month were not mentioned in the original presentation of the motion by Councillor Ridge, Councillor Jimmy Hassan brought the issue forward during the discussion.
I think seeing those incidents a few times, it is the right time to put everything into the right direction, work together, inclusively the city staff, all the community stakeholders, the organizations, and everyone who is involved there.
Councillor Ridge acknowledged this in his closing statement.
The terrible tragedy of September 12th has been mentioned by several other councillors, and I'd purposefully avoided mentioning it at the beginning, with the deaths of Taylor Wilkinson and John Hood. And while that is an impetus for renewed focus on safety and in general, I think with all of the partnership, this motion seeks a more holistic approach to what's been going on. Noting publicly that those incidents did happen in the encampment and not in the ICH itself. This motion is an effort to recognize an incredibly difficult situation, incredibly complex one. And the only way that we can ever solve issues like this is to have an honest conversation about what's going on. And if we polarize ourselves to one side or the other, where we're only recognizing, you know, the benefits as opposed to the harms, then or the harms as opposed to the benefits, we're not doing anyone any favors. And we're not going to get a solution that works for everybody.
Just before the end of the discussion, Councillor Jeff McLaren brought concerns to the table about these extra steps leading to overworking and burnout for ICH staff, and how this could impact the future of these services and Kingston's only safe consumption site.
So what I see here is that they're being forced to do extra work when they're already short-staffed. It seems to me that it's a way to get them to do a worse job by overwork, and I think we're contributing to that. We heard from somebody who seemed to be connected to this that they do not want the extra work. And at the same time, we need some of that data. That data, that's the other interesting thing about this. Based on what I've heard, partly at AMO and some of the requirements that I've heard recently from the provincial government, I think they're looking for a reason to kill this. And I think this is going to help. Not sure what to do yet.
The motion passed with a vote of 12-1, with Councillor McLaren opposed. Addiction and Mental Health Services KFLNA will be taking the lead to form the Community Consultation Group before the end of November. Councillors expressed hope that the community consultation meetings will be held on a regular basis by winter. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
CFRC from Kingston, Ontario. Your volunteer program, Campus and Community Radio at 101.9 FM and on the web at cfrc.ca.
Hey everyone, this is Joseph Guido. I am CFRC's Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence Project Intern. Do you love local music and supporting local arts? CFRC's annual funding drive is running until December 31st, and your gift is needed to help us provide local musicians with modern, top-of-the-line equipment, space, and technical support to better showcase their creativity on our airwaves all year round. Help us raise $25,000 this year. Make your gift today via cfrc.ca.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
After an eventful quarterfinal game, your Queens Gaels are still running down a dream. And on Saturday, November 2nd, they come face to face with the number one ranked, undefeated Wilfrid Laurier Golden Hawks. The stakes are high and the odds are stacked against the Gaels, but this is a team that makes the impossible look routine. Can the Gaels continue their incredible underdog run and dream the impossible dream? Or will the Golden Hawks send Queens crashing back to reality? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 12:45 p.m. for the Something in the Water pregame show ahead of the 1 p.m. kickoff. It is 12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca. Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, you also earn a ticket for one of our weekly raffle draws featuring prizes from local businesses including Old Farm Fine Foods, The Screening Room, Smokes Poutinerie, Studio 330, Tango Nuevo, Terra Natural Foods, The Toucan, The Wit, and YGK Thrift. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via CFRC.ca.